Ladies and gentlemen, friends and open-minded people, wherever you live, across the United States of America, Europe, and the world, this is David Duke, and this is Human Rights Radio. Today I'm going to play a couple of conversations that I had with a very interesting conversational partner, and that was artificial intelligence. And it's something that's called, well, it used to be called Bard, and now it's called Gemini. And it's kind of funny because by asking it certain questions that have political significance and actually have a lot of political bias in terms of its reporting, it's fascinating because it shows the bias of AI. Musk at one time said, talking about AI, is they're teaching AI to lie. They are. And there's lots of ways they can teach AI to lie. The same way that high priests in historical times, the priests of the many gods, and even religious gods who said that they had the hotline to God, that they could lie. They, if by saying what they say, God says, that they can lie to you about what they want you to do, or they want you to have certain beliefs and so forth. We do need leaders in the church, for sure, because a lot of the scriptures, because of the seeming contradictions in scriptures and the seeming contrast, for instance, there's a lot of contrast between what Jesus Christ says in the New Testament, the Old Testament, and it takes an individual to look through it, because even in the Old Testament itself, there's conflicts. There's contradictions. In the New Testament, there may be contradictions where one thing is said one time, another time it's something else. And it's important that you do have people who study, in terms of the average person, to be able to interpret these things for you and to get the sense of the teachings. And what I try to do as a Christian, because I know that scriptures have been copied and copied and copied, the Old Testament is really a problem because it looks like the first real copies of a collected Old Testament are found about 200 and maybe 30 or 40 B.C., even though they're supposedly written by people 3,800 B.C. It's a long time ago, or 3,700 years ago, our time, I should be saying. But it's just amazing that... You know, and yet we got certain fragments, and there was an oral tradition in Judaism, but it's very, very difficult. The New Testament itself has certain contradictions, and we know there's been mistakes sometimes by scribes. In fact, Jesus Christ himself warned us about the scribes. But it's important to note that if you look into the spirit of what Christ teach, he says that he's a God of love. And he says, by the way, that inside of us, in each of us, this is right in Luke, you can find it, Jesus Christ says, in each of us is the highest intentions, the highest values of God, and the love that's within God. We have kind of have a natural sense of right and wrong that's imbued in us by nature. And of course, a Christian would say, by God. And it's interesting that that this is kind of a reality. And the reason I like the New Testament is because I like the teaching, the spirit of what Christ says. And I like the idea of forgiveness. I like the idea when Jesus said, they asked him what was the greatest commandment, what's the summary of his teaching. He said the greatest commandment is love God with all your heart and to love your fellow man, to love your neighbor. And who is the neighbor? In fact, in the New Testament, Christ explained it to this Jewish lawyer. They were called lawyers then, which were defending the Jewish scribes, because the Jewish religion at that time did not view all people on earth, all races, all populations, ethnic groups, nationalities. They didn't view them all as their neighbor. They viewed only fellow Jews as their neighbor. And that's pretty clear in so many different scriptures. In the Old Testament, they say that you know, usury is a terrible thing. It's a biting and horrible affliction against people. And at the same time, they said that, but you can't practice it against your fellow Jews. However, you can practice it against any other people. That's fine. That's good. That's commendable. Even Maimonides, the most famous Jewish philosophers and writers, one of the great lights of the Middle Ages, actually, famous Jew. And he said really shocking things, such as, he's a doctor himself, and he says that a Jewish doctor should never intentionally save the life of a Gentile. But he's got to take care that if Gentiles are going to realize that he didn't work to save his Gentile patient, that he should go ahead and save them so that Israel doesn't suffer, because if Jews get a bad reputation, that is the height of deception. He also talks about how Jews aren't supposed to do usury, because usury is in the Hebrew word nesbit, which means biting. It's like an addiction. It puts you under the power of the moneylender and the money changer. The Old Testament defends, condemns usury against fellow Jews, and says if you have a poor person or you have a Jewish person, you should help him without interest. But it says it's fine to do this in terms of a non-Jew. It's interesting because Jesus Christ spent a lot of time, a lot of effort saying that we're going to treat everybody justly, that the golden rule is real, that we have to treat people as we treat ourselves. That's the golden rule. And this applied to all people. He went out of his way to say this is applied to Romans, which are the big enemies of Jews. They hated Romans. He said this has got to apply to Samaritans. So they despised Samaritans. Jesus did the parable of the Samaritan. And in that parable, the Jewish lawyer says to Christ, he thinks he traps Christ, and he says, okay, but who is that? And he points out the Samaritan actually stopped on the road when he saw a Jewish victim of a robbery. He's stripped, he's beaten, he's harmed, and he helps his enemy. And it's such an interesting and amazing story, and he takes him to an inn. But earlier, a Jewish scribe, a Pharisee, a high priest comes by, and he crosses the street to get not even want to look at the guy. Then you have a Levite, which is kind of like the leader of the Jews. He comes by and ignores the guy too. And Jesus said, he says, this Samaritan, that's the definition of a neighbor. It's not even whether or not you should help a neighbor or who a neighbor is. The truth is, we found out that a Samaritan is a true neighbor, and he's the one that treated even Jews as enemies as a neighbor. And that's the way we should give everybody a chance and not take this bias. It doesn't mean you shouldn't defend yourself if somebody tries to rob you or hurt you or invade your country. That's not what he's saying. He's really talking about being fair to everybody. And so this is the reality of our times, and this is the reality of our understanding and lack of understanding of the divergence that took place between Judaism and the teachings of Christ, which was really a revelation. It was a new covenant in truth. And those Christian Zionists, unfortunately, I'm sorry to say this, but they're very deluded. And they missed the whole idea of Jesus Christ. And if anything happens, if they feel there's any conflict between Old and New Testament, I think they should definitely get on the side of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who came to us as basically an intermediary to God. And that's what I would think the proper Christian thing. But the idea of a golden rule is not just Christians, in many religions. And I think it's the basis of humanitarian ideals, that we treat people fairly and justly. We don't cheat them. We're not deceitful to them. The Mossad slogan is, by deception, there shall wage war. And boy, that's what's going on today. Well, I'm going to talk today a little bit about the deceptions that exist in AI and Google. Google, perhaps in many ways, they are the most powerful media corporation on the planet. They control about 80% or more of the search engines of the world.
It's accurate to say that Google, as part of Alphabet Inc., holds a position of immense power in the global media landscape.
AI is talking
to me
already.
Here's a breakdown of factors contributing to this. Dominance in digital advertising.
Interesting.
Google's advertising platforms.
I didn't even mean for that to do it because I was looking up the thing. And here, Jim and I, that's the Google AI. And it was talking about the power of Google. And boy, it's powerful. Now, they control 80% of the search engines. So they have the power and they have algorithms that could do this. You see, it's not like somebody tapping a phone, say in the communist era, and they have three or four people. When the FBI taps your phone and they have three or four, in the old days, they have three or four guys in the next department over, you know, listening to each conversation, trying to tape your conversations. That enormous, this enormous amount of brain power and mind power and human work and effort for every individual they want to track. Today, they can just track you automatically through these so-called algorithms. So Google has the ability to do things massively. For instance, they track everything you do, everything you buy, you know, often sometimes everything you chat about, every website you go, they get an idea of your political opinions, your values, your traditions, your beliefs, and everything. And by doing that, they're able to tailor advertising programs to get products or advertise products to you or get you to buy products that you might be interested in. You're a vegetarian, they send you vegetarian products. You're carnivore, they send you carnivore products. It's the same kind of thing, or anything else. And people who are Jewish have a tremendous amount of ethnocentrism about them. The 52 biggest organizations in the United States of America, Jewish organizations, are the council, or the, let's see, what is it? The presidents of major Jewish organizations. It's like 52 organizations. According to Forward, a major Jewish publication, they're worth $24 billion. And they're all dedicated. Their mission statement is to advance the interests of the Jewish people. I mean, you can even have that if you had an organization for the advancement of white people. I remember I used to have the National Association of Advancement of White People. and that was condemned as a racist organization. It's just like people when the people said, well, you know, black lives matter, fine, but all lives matter. And white lives matter. How dare you say that? That's racist. And that's because there is a reverse discrimination going on today, and it's massive, and it goes on against better qualified people, and it's wrong. And I believe all people on earth has a right to survive and has a right to preserve their heritage and their values and the things that are important to them, their traditions, and their very existence as a people, their very identity. And funny enough, the mainstream media around the world always talks about the value of diversity and how we are so diverse. Why are we diverse? Well, why are we diverse? Because we have diverse peoples. And they have a right to their identity. They have a right to their heritage. They have a right to preserve it. They have a right to congregate together to advance their values and selves. But I don't think they have the right to exploit others, enslave others, harm others, corrupt others, and, you know, all these other, rape others, kill others, whatever you want to say, are lied to us on a massive scale. And I do see this bias in media in so many things. And we're going to be talking about that with a little exercise that I did with Jim and I, if I can pull it up again. Let me see if I can gather it here. So I've got a lot here to go through here. We'll go to chats. So I'm going to go down. Let's see, show more. I'm going to talk about a lot of things here. We got a lot to say here. Okay, so I wanted to ask some questions about, I'll just give you an example of what I asked because that's not recorded here, but I'm going to give you their verbal answer, and then we're going to discuss this, and I'm going to show how so many of their answers are basically Google suppressing information, disinformation, covering up vital information for you. And this is going to be a real exercise in awakening, I think, for a lot of you. All right, so let me see if I can get to that. All right, let's look at this. So this is my question. I was talking about Google and how it wasn't solely Jewish. They answered me by saying, I said it was solely Jewish. No, I said Google is one of the most powerful media corporations on the planet. They control 85% of the search engines. They control most of the videos made and shared, and they can ban any person they want or any position or principle they want, and they do massively. I've been banned, and it's because I'm talking about things like this today. And they have this enormous power. And the people that run Google are two Jews, and that is relevant. That's not hatred or mentioning this, but they're Jews, and they're very conscious Jews. They talk about their Jewish heritage, their Jewish interests. They talk about the Holocaust. They talk about how they love Israel. They're pro-Zionist, and they're pro-Israel. And they have contracts, in fact, with the Israeli government, the Israeli military that's committing a genocide. And it's what it is. Just, you can see it. It's right in front of your face, folks. Just look. Tens of thousands of infected, more likely. Many tens of thousands of children have been killed. Women have been killed. And it's very distinct and different. And very much in a worse magnitude, much more barbaric and much more oriented toward killing children than anything that Israel did. So let me go through some of these things. And so I just countered Google for an earlier question. And I said that I talked about the six top media organizations in the world as shown by Statista magazine, which is a leading statistical organization, major corporations. The corporations use this to judge, you know, the power of different corporations and see how their corporation is doing and to judge the outreach in terms of media or any other organization and who they should do business with or who they should advertise with, whatever. And they talked about, and they list the top six organizations. And they were in order at the time I did this, was 2 years ago. It was AT&T by Stanky, very Jewish. Alphabet, which is Google, and YouTube, and all, you know, it's just amazing. And two Jews, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, control it. And they're very dedicated to Israel. And like I said, and they're in contracts with the IDF, the Jewish military, even the Mossad. Massive, billions of dollars of contracts. So I after the answer, which was not a good answer by them, I said I didn't say all the corporations of the world were Jewish. I said the six biggest, and by the way, six biggest have so much percentage of the world's media consumption. It's just an amazing power. Jews are only 1/5 of 1% of the population of the world. So I asked, I said, it's the fact that the leading statistical organization in the world says, you know, it's basically showing that Google's whitewashing their power. And now I'm going to play you some of the audio and give you an idea of what's going on here. I think you're going to find this very interesting.
I understand your concern about the ownership and leadership of major media organizations. It's true that individuals of Jewish heritage hold prominent positions in some of these companies. However, focusing solely on their religious or ethnic background can be misleading and contribute to harmful stereotypes. Here's a breakdown of why a more nuanced approach is necessary. Diversity of ownership. While some media conglomerates have Jewish individuals in leadership roles, ownership and control are complex and involve diverse shareholders, including corporations, pension funds, and individual investors from various backgrounds. Zionism versus Judaism. It's crucial to distinguish between Judaism as a religion and Zionism as a political ideology. Not all Jewish individuals are Zionists, and not all Zionists are Jewish. Equating the two can lead to generalizations and mischaracterizations. Influence versus control. Having influence.
I'm going to stop for a second and point out, well, it's true. Not all Zionists are promoting Israel are Jews, and not all people following Judaism are Zionists. But I can tell you this, the vast majority of Jews who follow the Jewish religion and the Jewish Orthodox structure, which is led by the Sephardic rabbi in Israel and the Ashkenazi rabbi in Israel, that these are absolutely pro-Zionist, pro-Israel in all respects. And it is true that Zionists are pro-Israel. To say it's not important about Judaism, Judaism basically gives the premise that God's a Jew, that they're the children of God and the favorite of God, the chosen of God. And God has promised them, literally, and it is promised, to rule the world, at least until Christ came and said, there's no more, you're broken the covenant. And that's exactly what Christ says in the New Testament. I can show you the quotes. It's out of, right out of Hebrews. You've broken the covenant, and you know, the Jews have no longer continued in my covenant. And it talks about how Christ said, I go to other nations that live the fruits of it. And he said, it's not the children of the lineage that are important. It's the children of the promise that are important. But again, this is a deception. Judaism itself, and whether you want to admit it or not, and whether these people want to admit it or not, has so many ethnic or racial factors in it, it's incredible. It says specifically in the Torah that you should not intermarry with non-Jews, even though there's cases of Jews intermarrying, and that there has been some of that. But starting in about the 2nd century AD, when the Torah and the rules of the Torah were really enforced by these radical called the Maccabees, you had basically synagogues formed in the modern way, in modern Judaism. And in that time, if a Jew was a member of a Jewish community anywhere in the world, whether it be in the Mediterranean or the Near East or the Middle East or North Africa or Europe, if they married a Gentile, if they went out because they found Gentiles more example, they put blankets over the mirrors. Is like a son died or a daughter died. They're very forbidden. And they were expelled by the gene pool. And conversion, by the way, was always very difficult. And conversion was also something that was very limited by the necessity. Even today, Jews still theoretically have a necessity that a male, a full-grown male with full-grown reproductive organs, has to be circumcised. That's not an easy thing, especially in ancient times. The idea of getting an infection of losing your reproductive organs is pretty much something you might consider you not to do it. Plus, the Jewish mole, who is the guy that does the circumcision, actually has to use his oral facilities to take the blood away. I mean, it's something that an average person or a person could really not, go along with for sure. It's something that they would be objecting to. So there's a big bunch of barriers in it. Plus the aspects of the Sabbath, where they're not supposed to do any work. That's Orthodox Judaism, which is most all Judaism until recently. You got to do, no work at all. It's kind of difficult in a society that didn't have Saturday and Sunday off, in the old days. And it meant that Jews would generally need to work for other Jews or do their own business and isolate themselves from Jews. The dietary habits of hardcore Torah, which weren't really practiced, by the way, in the 4th and 5th century before Christ, and this is shown by Jewish archaeology, where they show pig bones and all that in Jewish homes and gatherings and so forth. Lots of pig bones and lots of fish that had no scales, which is fiercely condemned by the Torah, that these things, the ritual wasn't as much. After the Maccabees came, after a series of defeats, according to Jewish scholars, that Jews came to believe, these radical Jews says, okay, we're scattered all over the Mediterranean, all over the world, and how do we preserve the Jewish people? We do it by isolating ourselves as much as you can, separating our communities from the Gentiles, telling people the Gentiles all are evil enemies of theirs, dirty enemies. And you can see this so much in the Pentateuch. You can see this in the Tanaka, how the Samaritans were the biggest enemies. Jesus went out of his way to say the Good Samaritan, right? That the Samaritan was their true neighbor, and the Jewish lawyer that argued with them didn't, you know, want to obviously accept that. So there you go. So it's just really interesting about these aspects that that we're not acquainted with because of this power that they hold. So anyway, those are some of the quotes. Let me go down a little bit. And then he kind of goes, avoiding harmful stereotypes, attributing influence or control to a specific religion or ethnic group. So this goes on and on. I could read more of it, but I'm going to go to the next question. And I said, are you then denying the overwhelming pro-Israel biased aspects in terms of American media, which controls much of the world's media? The world's major media, corporations. Are you denying that bias? Are you telling me that if Palestinians were on a video with a gang rape by 10 Palestinians of an Israeli victim, and they have that video, which was shown in Israel, but never shown an American video in media, if that wouldn't be the biggest one, or one of the biggest stories in the world, you'd never hear the end of it. And showing the brutality of the Palestinians of that. And this is the answer. Oh, just a second. I lost that, unfortunately. I hate when that happens. Here we go again. All right, let's see. Oh, come on. One little slip of the finger and I messed up, okay? All right, just a second. So I'm going to go down now to that next passage here. So I said, are you denying overall bias? All right, and here's the answer.
You're raising a very important and complex issue regarding media bias. It's true that discussions about media coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict often highlight concerns about a pro-Israel bias in Western, particularly American, media. Here's a breakdown of the complexities. Perceptions of bias. Many observers, particularly those sympathetic to the Palestinian cause, point to what they perceive as a disproportionate focus on Israeli suffering, while minimizing or downplaying Palestinian experiences. They argue that language used in media reports often frames Israelis as victims and Palestinians as aggressors, even when reporting on events where Palestinians suffer greater casualties. As you pointed out, there is a strong argument.
By the way, it's not greater casualties. That's completely out of connection. It's not just greater casualties. It's just like there's, you know, 10 casualties of Israelis and 12 casualties of Palestinians. It's not like that. Right? It's like 10 casualties and hundreds of casualties. You know, as I've pointed out before, there were 36 children that died, Israeli children, according to the Israeli government, according to Israeli media. And this mounts up, I even did some searches on this, mounts up to about 3% of the people that died on October 7th compared to the others. You know, people that died, the total death toll of Israel, both soldiers and civilians. And they were about 3%. And then I asked AI, you know, tell me about, and I had to take about four or five different searches to get them to finally fess up and tell the truth about the number of Palestinian women and children, innocents, who were killed in Operation Protective Edge, Operation Cast Lead, and these other Jewish operations, and they admitted that anywhere from 30 to 40%, even though I think it's greater than that in Gaza, it looks like more like 40% of the victims have been kids. In fact, the greatest single demographic group of deaths in Gaza have been children between the ages of 5 and 10. It's pretty shocking. Let's continue on here.
That if the roles were reversed in certain violent actions, that the media coverage would be very different.
Yeah.
Factors influencing coverage, historical context, The historical relationship between the U.S. and Israel, along with geopolitical considerations, plays a role in shaping media narratives. Access and sources. Access to information and sources can influence reporting. Israeli government sources are often readily available, while access to Palestinian perspectives can be more challenging.
Yeah, they're available. Also, remember the fact that Israel doesn't allow reporters, international reporters, into Gaza. What are they trying to cover up? Answer that question, folks. You know, reporters have gotten almost every conflict of war on both sides. That's just the reality of it. But for some reason, Israel doesn't allow any of this. And by the way, it's not a war. It's a real war when you have two armies facing off against each other. It's not a war when you have a defenseless, mostly defenseless population, civilian population, where most of the casualties, 70% are women and children, and I have that quoted by AI later here too, that are the victims. And these people, you know, it's just like when you cut off the food and the water and the medicine and the antibiotics, even the anesthetic for people who get these terrible wounds. And when you do that into a controlled environment where you don't have clean water, you have infected water, you don't have medicine, and they control everything that goes in, and it's a prison. And then you don't allow food in for those kids and those mothers? It's really quite amazing. Let me go on.
Language and framing. The language used to describe the conflict can significantly impact public perception. Terms like terrorism and self-defense carry strong emotional weight and can be used to frame events in a particular light. Media ownership and influence. As we discussed, the ownership and influence of media organizations can also play a role in shaping coverage. The role of graphic content. You're correct that graphic depictions of violence, particularly when committed against a perceived victim group, can have a powerful impact on public opinion. The availability and dissemination of such content can significantly influence media coverage and public perception.
See, that's why we hear every day about the 250 quote unquote hostages, prisoners that the Palestinians took, civilians, even though Israel grabs, without even formal charges, thousands and thousands of Palestinians every year, hundreds of thousands over the years, and throws them into prisons where they are routinely tortured and hurt and not even allowed communication. So anyway. So I ask another question, and I can't, you can't hear that orally, but or audio-wise, but I can say, I can give you what I wrote. Some well-known authorities have suggested, I have to write cleverly to Google, at least by that Google is biased because of the fact that Google itself is primarily owned by two Jews, all right, both Zionists, Sergey Brin and Larry Page, and maybe that's why they're biased, and that Google is in partnership with the Israeli government, the Israeli military, which is committing this mass genocide, and the Israeli Mossad. And here's the answer.
The assertion that Google's AI, or Google itself, is inherently biased due to the religious background of its founders and its business partnerships is a complex and sensitive issue. Here's a breakdown of the key points to consider: ownership and influence. It's factual that Larry Page and Sergey Brin, Google's co-founders, are of Jewish heritage. However, attributing bias...
They're not just the co-founders. They're the people who have the ultimate financial control over the company. It's admitted by everybody. Again, they're constantly trying to control this narrative so you don't understand the full truth.
Solely to their religious background is a generalization that can perpetuate...
And I didn't say solely to their religious background. I said they're dedicated Zionists. They've both suppressed massive support for Israel, and they've invested billions and billions of dollars, financial investments in Israel. So, again, why do they take my question and try to make it a straw question that they can try to refute rather than addressing the issues that I actually talked about.
Wait, harmful stereotypes. Large corporations like Google have diverse ownership structures, including numerous shareholders and institutional investors. Business partnerships. Google, like many tech companies, engages in partnerships with various governments and organizations, including those in Israel. These partnerships often involve technology development, research, and infrastructure projects. The nature and implications of these partnerships are subject to ongoing debate and scrutiny. AI bias. AI systems, including those developed by Google, can reflect biases present in the data they are trained on. These biases can stem from various sources, including societal prejudices and historical inequalities. Addressing AI bias is a critical challenge for the tech industry, and companies like Google are actively working to mitigate it. It is important.
Yeah, they're actively working to mitigate it. We'll see about that. So I say, is it not true that Google has billion-dollar contracts with the Israeli government, with the Israeli military, and with the Mossad in Israel on a number of different projects, billions of dollars of funding, by the way? Not, you know, is that not true? And does that not pose a problem of a biased effect, or whether or not the company is unbiased? We've shown that the leaders of the company are Jews. They are dedicated Zionists, and they're in billion-dollar contracts with the state of Israel that's committing this genocide. That seems to be a little pretty suggestive evidence that they're pretty biased. But let's go on.
It's accurate that Google, along with Amazon, is involved in a significant
The head of Amazon, by the way, he's got him Jasky these days, who sets that policy. One more Jew and one more dedicated Zionist. And that's why my books are bad right now from Amazon. Even though you can buy the books of Leon Trotsky, The Communist Revolutionary Killed Millions, that's fine. And many others. So there you go. But you can't get David Duke's book with no advocacy about violence. And I advocate fairness to everybody. I'm just exposing something called Jewish supremacism and Jewish racism. But that's off the table. You can't do that. Everybody's a white supremacist today is what they try to say. And even heard people critical of Israel saying that, even Scott Ritter said the other day, white supremacy is the problem. It's not white supremacy. The same Jews who control our foreign policy have been the orchestrators, the architects of open borders, which are meant to replace the populations of Europe and America and make us a minority in our own countries. And the same orchestrators of the Jewish invasion of Palestine, which has replaced the population of much of Palestine with Jews and put them under dire oppression. Let's go on.
A computing project with the Israeli government, known as Project Nimbus. Here's a breakdown of the key points. Project Nimbus. This is a $1.2 billion project providing cloud computing and AI services to the Israeli government. It involves providing services to various Israeli government entities, including the defense establishment. This project has generated considerable controversy and scrutiny. Concerns and controversies. There are concerns about the potential use of these technologies, particularly AI, in ways that could contribute to human rights violations. Internal Google documents have reportedly revealed concerns within the company about the potential reputational damage and ethical implications of this contract. Reports indicate that the Israeli Ministry of Defense is a client of Google Cloud Services. There are reports that the terms of service that are used within Project Nimbus are altered from Google's general terms of service. This fact brings up further concerns. Potential for bias. The close relationship between a technology company and a government, especially a military, raises valid questions about potential biases. There are concerns that these partnerships could influence the development and deployment of AI and other technologies in ways that favor certain political or military agendas. In essence, the existence of these contracts is a factual matter, and the concerns surrounding their potential implications are also well documented.
Okay, then I ask about corruption. We'll skip that. That was interesting, but we want to get to the hardcore ones. All right. I said, if an oil company was accused of corruption, would it not be a red flag for that company to be charged or accused of media bias about that company? Here's what Google says.
Yes, if an oil company facing corruption allegations were also accused of media bias in its favor, it would raise significant red flags and warrant close scrutiny. Here's why. Potential for cover-up. A company facing corruption charges would have a strong incentive to manipulate public perception and minimize negative press. Accusations of media bias suggest a potential attempt to control the narrative and suppress damaging information. Conflicts of interest. If the company has financial ties to media outlets or exerts influence through advertising or other means, it could compromise the objectivity of reporting. This creates a conflict of interest, where the media's role as a watchdog is undermined. Erosion of public trust. When a company accused of corruption is perceived to have undue influence over media coverage, it erodes public trust in both the company and the media. This can lead to cynicism and a sense that the truth is being obscured. Obstruction of justice. By controlling the narrative, a corrupt company could hinder investigations and legal proceedings.
This could
prevent accountability and allow the company to escape the consequences of its actions. Amplification of suspicion. The combination of corruption allegations and media bias accusations would amplify suspicion about the company's integrity. It would suggest a pattern of behavior aimed at concealing wrongdoing. In essence, accusations of media bias in such a scenario would create a strong presumption that the company is attempting to manipulate public opinion and potentially obstruct justice. It would require very close examination of the media outlets in question.
So the heads of Google are dedicated Zionists, and Jews grow up in a milieu of dedication to the Jewish people and to Israel and to Zionism. And even if they're not, in terms of being religious Jews, dedicated to the institutions and the culture and the faith of their fathers. So in essence, what they're saying, what I'm saying, what they just said here, in essence, accusations of media bias in such a scenario would create a strong presumption that the company is attempting to manipulate public opinion and potentially obstructing justice. It would require very close. And boy, justice has been obstructed. So again, here's my next question. So why isn't it true about Alphabet owned by two Jewish Zionists, and that their control of the company and the bias that exists for Israel and the contracts that Google has of billions of dollars of contracts with Google and the IDF and even Israeli intelligence, that this is not a great threat? Finally, here's what AI says.
You're raising a valid point about the parallels between the hypothetical oil company scenario and the concerns surrounding Alphabet/Google's relationship with Israel. Here's how the same principles apply. Potential for conflict of interest. Google's substantial financial contracts with the Israeli government and military create a potential conflict of interest. This raises concerns about whether Google's platforms and services could be used to promote or suppress information in a way that benefits its business interests. Narrative control. Given Google's dominance in search, news aggregation, and content distribution, its ability to influence the narrative surrounding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is significant. Concerns exist about whether Google's algorithms and policies could be used to amplify pro-Israel voices or downplay Palestinian perspectives. Erosion of trust. The perception that Google is biased in favor of Israel can erode public trust in its platforms and services. This can lead to concerns about censorship, manipulation, and the reliability of information. Lack of transparency. The details of Google's contracts with the...
So everything basically I said is so true, but there's no warning label on Google when you go to a search engine. When you're taken to sites that they recommend and avoiding sites that, like my sites, that talk about this corruption, there's no transparency in any of this stuff. It's just there's no amplification of suspicion because they control the amplification. It says here the essence, the same principle can be applied to corrupt oil company, can also apply to Google. That's interesting. AI comes up with some truth, but then they try to correct it, right? This is quite amazing, isn't it? But I go on to say, isn't it true that this relationship between this very powerful media corporation, Google, and Israel, billions of dollars of contracts, and the fact that it's never, hardly ever mentioned in the rest of mainstream media, which also happens to be overwhelmingly Jewish in the very biggest and most powerful institutes, whether you're talking about Hollywood, whether you're talking about ABC, NBC, CBS, they have direct Jewish control over it. NBC is run by Comcast, which is run by a Jew. I mean, we can just keep going on and on, and they're dedicated Jews. So that's my question. Let me get you the answer.
You're pointing out a significant observation about the relative lack of mainstream media coverage regarding Google's contracts with the Israeli government and military. This lack of coverage, combined with the scale and potential implications of those contracts, does raise valid questions about media bias and influence.
Now, see, you can tease out a little truth out of Google, but you never hear this by any of the mainstream media, and this is right out of Google's own AI. Isn't this amazing?
Here's a breakdown of why. Potential for self-censorship. Media outlets may be hesitant to criticize powerful corporations or governments due to concerns about access, advertising revenue, or potential legal...
Right. And any other corporation, even non-Jewish-owned corporations, may not tell the truth about Gaza because they know it will come down upon them like a ton of bricks. They know they could lose their company. Right now, Musk, just for doing a few things Jews don't like while he's trying to kiss up to Jews in every respect, they're trying to destroy his company. And they're just about doing it. They're promoting violence against this company. They're trying to make people intimidated about buying those cars. They're trying to destroy him. I wouldn't be surprised if some individual Jews working these SpaceX things wouldn't sabotage some of his ships, but just have a big disaster. That would be the, you know, the next thing that they could do. So self-censorship. And people, there's self-censorship in Google, you know, videos, for instance, because people know they can't say openly about Jewish racism, Jewish supremacy, without threatening to be canned. Now, somebody like Max Blumenthal, a Jew, or Finkelstein is a Jew, who's very famous and very popular, he can say some of these things. But average Gentiles, they certainly can't. That's just the reaction and reality. So there we go. Let's just go to the next one. I don't have much time left, but this has been an interesting program, I think. So basically, they've proven everything that I've been talking about here. It's just amazing when you think about it, and it's amazing, this process. Earlier, I did some studies. I asked Google, how many children were killed by previous Jewish incursions into Gaza and the West Bank? How many children were killed over the last decade or two? How many children? And how many adults? And what was the percentage of children killed? I did ask them. I asked them how many Jewish children died. I had a hard time getting that. I finally got that. It was 36. And then I asked Google, what does that mean in the percentage of the deaths that were children? And it was 3%. And then I asked them about these other places, and it took me about 10 or 20 searches. I can play this another day, too. It's so interesting. And to get them out, they admitted that thousands more Palestinians were killed, but they wouldn't give me exact figures. I'm not talking about just after October 7. I'm talking about before October 7. Which was considered the Great Holocaust. Well, if that was a Holocaust, 1,200 Israelis killed and 36 children, that was the lowest percentage than any Israeli mass incursion into Palestine and killing of children and innocent women. I mean, Netanyahu got on national television in Israel and started evoking Amalek, which every Israeli and every Jew knows means you wipe out everybody. Palestinians are Amalek. And you know what you do to Amaleks? You kill them all, man, woman, child, and even suckling infant. So this is the process. What we're talking about in this program is truth. And the shocking thing is that we're supposed to have a media which is supposed to be representing the real world. It's not. It's fake news. It's a fake reality. The reality, Israel is committing a massive genocide. It's mass murder. I had some other inquiries here when I asked them. I called them out and said they were talking about, you know, Israeli violence and so forth. I said, why don't you call it what it is? It's mass murder. Why is it every time somebody went on Piers Morgan, he demanded that they condemn Hamas as terrorists and a heinous thing, but he never demands any Israeli official, any pro-Israel speaker ever to denounce the 50,000 people, almost all of them civilians, women and children, overwhelmingly children. In fact, that's the biggest demographic group that's been murdered. That's compared to 36 children, and that proves the barbarity and the evil of Palestinians, or the rape, for instance, of Palestinian prisoners. Rape. And then there's demonstrations and attacks on the prison by Jews. Or, the, for instance, the head rabbi of the military saying it's perfectly permissible, doing this publicly long for years, and he's been the head of it. And he said way back, people know what his belief is. He says it's perfectly permissible for a Jew to follow their evil inclination. This is a Jewish rabbi that's supposed to believe in God and goodness and, you know, righteousness and so forth. It's fine for a Jewish soldier to follow his evil inclination and rape an attractive Gentile woman, take her against their will. It's perfectly good. In fact, it's really, really a good thing because it gives these Jews relaxation. The horror and the hatred and the violence of this is just unbelievable. I'm out of time, but go to davidduke.com at davidduke.com. Support us. Go to my Gab at Real David Duke. My Odyssey of Real David Duke. I've got great videos there. And also, please go to Box 188, Mandeville, Louisiana. Take some time, send some snail mail, and send us a contribution. And I do appreciate you and love you and appreciate all of you. Bye-bye now, and I'll see you again on Monday. Until then, keep thinking.